From then, we will get to the continuum formulation of the Heisenberg model and deduce spin waves and see how they are bosons carrying one quantum of angular momentum. So the Heisenberg ferromagnet is a rather simple toy model, which nonetheless captures many essential features of magnets that we deal today with. So if you look at this system at the atomic level, you will see that there are atomic dipoles, magnetic dipoles, all lined up in the ground state, doing something like that. Okay, so I've drawn here a picture in two dimensions, but you can extend the lattice in the third dimension as well. Something like a cubic lattice ferromagnet, where the spins like to point parallel to each other. So each of these is a magnetic moment. Mu, that is proportional to the spin. So some number gamma times the angular momentum of an individual particle. So gamma is the gyromagnetic ratio. That's literally the constant that connects a mechanical moment to a magnetic moment. So for starters, we'll consider these to be classical objects. And so I can write the angular momentum of an atom or an ion as its length times m, where m is the unit vector. And so what we'll be interested in today is the dynamics of these unit vectors of magnetization. So m refers to magnetization, hence m. So if you want to write down the dynamics, you can start with a Lagrangian. And if you prefer a continuum formulation, then you want some sort of a Lagrangian density. And the Lagrangian density typically includes some kinetic energy density minus potential energy density. And we can write down a very plausible expression for U, the potential energy. So all the moments like to line up. It doesn't matter in which direction they point. The energy will be the same whether they point all upwards, all downwards, or in any other direction. And so the potential energy then should not depend on the direction of the moments, but it should penalize the deviation from collinearity between these spins. If they're slightly non-parallel, then there should be a penalty, and that penalty will be written in the following form. It's the gradient squared, basically. Partial Im dot partial Im. Right. So if magnetization varies in space, then it means that spins are not parallel to each other, and so the energy will be non-zero. So the question is now, so a ground state, so minimized by a uniform configuration of magnetization. The question now is, what is the kinetic energy of spins? How do you propose we write the kinetic energy? So think of a spin as a particle in a unit sphere, right? So given by this vector, how would you write its kinetic energy? Yeah, something like some density times m dot squared divided by 2, right? It turns out that spins don't work that way. they don't have a kinetic energy. So we'll have to figure out what they have. And so that's what we'll do in the next 10 minutes. Have you played with gyroscopes? They're weird, right?
So
if you have a gyroscope, which is basically a spinning wheel, right? So the wheel is spinning like this. It has an angular momentum pointing this way. And the magnitude of the angular momentum is fixed, right? It's determined by the speed with which it's spinning, right? So it'll be something like that, where n is this unit vector. So there's a wheel or something spinning like this. If you try to tip the gyroscope axis in this direction, what's going to happen? It persists, right? It's not going to accelerate in this direction, but rather it's going to persist in which direction? Well, we can figure it out. If the force is applied this way, and it's applied at this point, so R is the vector from the center to the point of the force application, there is a torque that is R cross F. So R cross F points into the board. And the torque gives the change in angular momentum, right? And so that's J times N dot. So it's going to move in that direction. So let's pretend our spins are little gyroscopes, which is precisely what they are, right? Just like for a gyroscope, there is a fixed magnitude of angular momentum, but it can point in any direction. Right, so if we have a spin here, and we imagine that the spin has some length A, which is a complete fabrication, there's no spin length. So I'll have to wiggle out of this, I'll have to cancel somehow this quantity A, right? So this size is A. You apply a force to the spin, right? And so what you do then is you use this equation. R cross F equal J times M dot this time, right? So M is the direction of unit vector here. So the force I can write as the derivative of potential energy with respect to the position of the tip, right? And since both R in the numerator and in the denominator are proportional to this fictitious constant of length A, A cancels out. And I can write my equation for the precession of the spin in the following way. So I'll have J M dot equals negative M cross partial U partial M. So this is the equation of motion for a spin. Right? I'm going to make it slightly more familiar, slightly more reminiscent of Newton's second law, which has forces and maybe accelerations and maybe something else. So let me multiply both sides by M vectorially, right? So I'm going to multiply that here. So and then I'm going to lump everything together. So just bring everything on the left-hand side. So I'll have M cross partial U partial M plus J M cross M dot equal to zero. And using your favorite vector identity, A cross B cross C equals B A dot C minus C dot AB, I will have something like this. Right, so it's going to be minus partial U partial M plus m times m dot partial u partial m. And this term I'll just rewrite it in a slightly different way. Just switch the order. J m dot cross m equal to 0. So what I'm going to do next is restrict the motion of the unit vector in such a way that it only moves along the sphere. Well, a unit vector is supposed to move along the sphere only, right? So this derivative will only have components along that tangential to the sphere. There should be no component along the direction of magnetization. So I can forget about this term and just remember that all the differentiation takes place tangentially, right? So this is the components tangential to the sphere. And so mine is du dm. Just like the gradient of potential energy is in Cartesian space, where, this would be a force in the spherical space. So this equation of motion is pretty much Newton's second law, except it doesn't have any ma term. There's no mass times acceleration because spins don't have intrinsic inertia. So they act like gyroscopes. That's our model of spins. And before discussing the nature of this sort of dynamics, I'm going to add one more term that will be viscous dissipation. Right? So this I can think of as a force term. So let me move this up. Right, so I just restrict my motion to the sphere, and therefore I'm not calculating any component normal to the sphere or along the radius vector m. Right, so partial u partial m will only have tangential components, and that's why this term will vanish. Right, so I'm going to add one more term. So now we can interpret these terms. This term comes from differentiating the potential energy with respect to displacements on the sphere. And so this represents conservative forces. Right. So if there's some potential energy, you can derive forces from that by taking a gradient with a minus sign. That's precisely that. This term I can think of as a phenomenological viscous force, right? It's proportional to the velocity. So if the spin is moving on top of the sphere in this direction, there will be a viscous force opposing its motion, right? So it's a viscous force. And there is one more kind of force, which you have to tell me what kind of force this is. It's also proportional to the velocity. It looks like the Coriolis force, right? Any other analogs? Coriolis force is very good. I want something else. The Lorentz force. How about the Lorentz force, right? If you have, the Lorentz force would be E V cross B. So in this case, we can just read off, this is the velocity. M is the magnetic field, or J times M is the magnetic field, right? So V is M dot. The magnetic field is J times M with a minus sign, right? So there's a minus sign in front of this. And let's say the electric charge is 1, so something like that. So this is like a Lorentz force. So here we have Newton's second law written with three forces of very different kinds. Conservative, Lorentz-like, sometimes we call this the gyrotropic forces or gyroscopic forces. and a viscous or dissipative force. So they're very different in nature. Conservative forces you can represent in terms of a potential energy as it is represented here. Viscous forces cannot be described in the Lagrangian formalism unless you add the dissipation function. You can read about that in standard textbooks. I'm not going to bother with that. It's just here for the purpose of analyzing this Newton's second law. How do you represent gyroscopic forces in Lagrangians? How do you represent the Lorentz force in the Lagrangian?
E squared minus B squared.
Well, that doesn't, E squared minus B squared represents the energy of the field, or the Lagrangian of the field. So how do we represent the motion of a particle in the magnetic field?
JU.
So it's V dot A, right? So you add to the Lagrangian a term that looks like E V dot A, where the curl of the vector potential is the magnetic field, right? So that's how we do this. And so now we're going to write down the Lagrangian of a spin. So it's going to have minus the potential energy, and it's going to have EV dot A, E is one, V is M dot, and B, and so then A would be something else. So I will write it as follows. It's A of M, using little a, multiplying m dot, where the curl of magnetization in spherical coordinates is minus j times m. That's the magnetic field. What is the magnetic field of? So this is the sphere in which our spin lives. And the magnetic field points like this. Exactly. It's the magnetic field of a monopole. Right? So if you have your spin right here at the top and you push it this way, it's not going to accelerate in this direction. The equilibrium condition, which is written over there, tells us that whatever external force you have plus the Lorentz force is going to be zero if we neglect viscous effects.
Doesn't this condition that you can generate the magnetization of the curl of the vector field impose a divergence condition?
Excellent question. We'll get to that. Dirac strings is the answer. Just wait 10 minutes. Right, so this condition tells us that it's the equilibrium of the Lorentz force, or the gyroscopic force, and the external force. This is the external force. In order for the Lorentz force to point in the opposite direction, you have to have a velocity in the direction perpendicular to that. And so it'll persist. That's precisely how it works.
Now we are interpreting
as a magnetic field. No, no, no. It works as if there were a magnetic field here pointing inward, and as if this were a charged particle. This is just an analogy, right? It's not literally that we have a spin like a single particle, you know, small particle in a sphere, right? There's no sphere to begin with. There is just a spin, a vector in some abstract space. But it behaves like a particle on a sphere would if there were a magnetic field surrounding the sphere and the particle would have a charge. Yeah. So it's an analogy, but it's a useful analogy. Okay. So we need to write down some form of a vector potential that has this property, that its curl gives a radially convergent magnetic field. So as you might know from your previous experience with magnetic fields and vector potentials, even though a magnetic field might be symmetric in some sense, a vector potential corresponding to it will not be that symmetric, right? If you think, for instance, about a magnetic field that points along the z-axis, a vector potential that yields it could have the form minus y b 0, 0. So this was translationally invariant, but a is not translationally invariant. In fact, it has to change with y. Or you could write it as 0 x b 0 or something like that, right? So there are different gauges in which you can represent one and the same magnetic field. So the same happens in our spherical space. Even though the magnetic field B is spherically symmetric, you rotate the sphere, the magnetic field doesn't change, the vector potential cannot be chosen in a similarly symmetric way. And so what we will do is we'll use unit vectors tangential to the sphere. And since we've agreed not to use the direction normal to the sphere anymore, right, so if you have a sphere, so for instance here, theta is this angle from the north pole, and e theta would be the unit vector tangential to the sphere and going in the direction south. Right, and phi would be the unit vector that points in the counterclockwise direction if you watch it from the north pole. So that's the e phi vector. So if you write it like this, one can choose a gauge in which a theta is 0 and a phi would be j times cosine theta minus 1 divided by sine theta. So one can go through the exercise of calculating the magnetic flux through some circle on the sphere, and one can figure out that this does correspond to the right. This one? Little a?
Yeah.
So this is what the contribution to the Lagrangian is for charge moving in the magnetic field, right? So we figured that the spin moves on the unit sphere in the same way as a charge in the presence of a magnetic field. So a charge moving in the field has this addition to the Lagrangian. It's v dot a.
Where a is generic and only has to satisfy that equation there,
yes.
Right? That's why you can choose a
gauge. So in fact, if you make a gauge transformation, right? So gauge transformations are going from a to a plus the gradient of some function of spatial coordinates. Right? If you add something like this to the Lagrangian, then the Lagrangian changes to something like this. It's ev dot the gradient of that function. Sorry, yeah. So that's L plus E V dot DF DR. And so this actually, since V is DR DT, this turns out to be nothing but adding a full time derivative to the Lagrangian. And if you add a full time derivative, then nothing happens to the equations of motion. Right? So a gauge transformation will not change the action. Yeah, it's related to conservation laws, yes. Gauge invariance and conservation of charge are basically flip sides of the same coin. So any other questions about this vector potential and all that? So the analogy is simply that. It's just an analogy, right? So if you want to know how a gyroscope moves, you can say it's analogous to the motion of a charged particle in a magnetic field, but you can also say that we have a Coriolis force. It's like moving in a rotating frame or something like that, right? So you can derive the Coriolis force and see how it enters the Lagrangian. It'll be the same result. So basically you have to have a vector potential of a magnetic monopole or what looks like it. Okay. So tell me what's wrong with this vector potential. It has one big problem. It diverges, right? Where? At the south pole. Right. So it has sine theta in the denominator, which vanishes when theta is 0 or pi. At the north pole, everything is fine because the numerator vanishes even faster. Right? But at the south pole, there is a problem. And in fact, there is an even bigger conceptual problem. So let's calculate the magnetic flux through a contour with a constant theta. Right? So I just take the sphere and I make a contour that looks like this. So it's just the theta equal to a constant contour. So this flux would be the integral of the vector potential dotted with the displacement element, right? So in for a real magnetic field, it would be the integral of A dot dr or the integral of the magnetic field through the same contour. All right, and so that's going to be A theta d theta plus A phi sine theta d phi. So we've agreed that A theta is 0. So nothing from here. And then it's going to be the integral from 0 to 2 pi over phi. A phi has sine theta downstairs, cancels against sine theta from the displacement. And so you get J times cosine theta minus 1. So the integral is trivial, just gives you a 2 pi, right? So it's 2 pi times J times cosine theta minus 1. So let's evaluate it for some simple situations. If theta is much smaller than 1, you're near the north pole. You expand theta, cosine theta in powers of theta, it'll be minus theta squared over 2, right? So then the flux would be minus pi j theta squared. Right. So pi theta squared is the area of this loop. Right? So if you're looking from the north pole, so the theta is a small radius and you have a circle of that radius. So this, the area is certainly pi theta squared. The magnetic flux is minus J, and that's the result you obtain. So that makes sense. If theta is pi over 2, then the flux is going to be minus 2 pi J, which makes sense because basically now it's half of the sphere. The magnetic flux is minus J per unit area, and the area is 2 pi. Half of the sphere, right? So minus 2 pi j. So far so good, right? You can check other values, but let's say theta goes towards pi. Right, so now we're around the south pole, and as you're closing in on the south pole, you'll have a very small integration area inside, right? So you should get a small flux there. Just like the flux near the north pole is small, the flux near the south pole should be also small. But if you plug things in, cosine theta is nearly minus 1. You get minus 4 pi j. So the strange thing is that at the south pole, even though you have a tiny little contour, you have a finite flux going through this contour. Why is that? Hmm? It's the Dirac string, yes. But you can say it that way, but in principle, you can also blame the fact that you have two surfaces separated by this contour, right? It's not clear whether we're talking about this internal surface or the external surface. So the external one has area 4 pi j, sorry, 4 pi, and the flux is minus j, so that result actually is valid. But how do we know whether we should take the outside part or the inside part? You know, on the sphere, you can't tell which one is inside, which one is outside. So they're both kind of inside. So there's an uncertainty here. So in principle, this should be small, but it's not, right? So the direct string is the graceful exit from this situation. In fact, what you can say is that, as someone pointed out initially, we can only represent, in terms of a vector potential, a magnetic field that has zero divergence. In other words, there is no source. But this field clearly has a source at the center of the sphere, right? So it's not representable in terms of a vector potential in principle, not by honest means. So here we were a little bit dishonest trying to square a circle, right? Which you cannot do. And so mathematics pretty much said, okay, let's do that. And it let us do that, but at the expense of having this indeterminacy to some degree. In other words, you can say that the magnetic flux is actually zero, but it's zero in the following way. So you have magnetic field coming in from all sides. And then at the south pole, there's a tiny little tube through which the magnetic field is going out. Very thin tube, very thin because there's a finite flux going through an infinitely thin thing, and that's what gives a divergence. Right? So if you represent this field where the magnetic field is coming in with density minus j, and it's exiting with a finite flux 4 pi j, then this field has zero divergence and it can be represented by that vector potential.
Could you explain again why we have a field with divergence in the first place?
Well, if you have a sphere and the magnetic field points in everywhere.
Yeah, but why does it?
So it means that it's the field of a magnetic charge. Right, its divergence is non-zero, strictly speaking, only at the center of the sphere, right? So on the sphere, strictly speaking, it has zero divergence. But it's not a solenoidal field. The lines terminate inside the sphere, which they shouldn't, okay? So the construction that escapes this problem is the one where you have to return the flux coming into the sphere somewhere. And so in this gauge, it's returned through the south pole. You can use other gauges where the magnetic flux will return through the North Pole or elsewhere, in fact. So the North Pole string will look like this. So you'll have to have a divergence at theta equal to zero. And the corresponding gauge will have j times cosine theta plus 1 divided by sine theta. All right, so now the South Pole is okay. The North Pole is not okay. So that's where the direct string is attached at the North Pole.
I'm still having trouble understanding physically what that means. We're talking about magnetic fluxes and all, but that was all an analogy with M in the first place. So yeah. What's actually happening?
Well, as a theoretical physicist, you have to live with analogies.
Right?
So mathematics is a language. We're writing a nice poem here. I'm serious. If you're a theoretical physicist, this is how you should think about your subject.
It's a magnetic dipole, right? It's not a moment.
It's the magnetic dipole in the sense that it does have a magnetic dipole moment. But here, we're not even talking about its magnetic properties yet. Forget about the fact that it's a magnet. We're just thinking about the mechanics of spin, right? So you can do this same thing with a fast spinning gyroscope. You don't need to have a spin. It will have the exact same problems, okay? When you write down the Lagrangian you can just derive it from mechanics. It will have some inertia because to begin with, you build it from particles. But it will also have this Berry phase term. I didn't say the words Berry phase yet, but this this Lorentz-like thing or the Coriolis-like thing, it will be there, right? And you will have to somehow put it into a Lagrangian. The only way to do this is to use a vector potential. So It's inescapable. It's there, right? And so we'll see now that this problematic Dirac string actually is our good friend because it will help us quantize the spins. Just like the Dirac string leads to quantization of electric and magnetic charges, it leads to quantization of spin length. Yes?
Some observable effect. So I mean, at that point, there's a small, very thin tube and like a flux. So can we observe that, or is it just a mathematical equation?
I'm coming right to it now.
Okay.
So of course, there's a problem because there is this supposedly invisible string. It's invisible in classical mechanics if I'm sure that the dynamics of my spin doesn't take it to the South Pole, right? So if it just hangs around the North Pole, never crosses the equator, I can forget about this thing because it's inaccessible to my spin, right? Because if it hits the string, there's a huge magnetic field here, so it should feel it. But if I know that its dynamics is restricted to the south, northern hemisphere, that's okay. If I know that it's moving around the southern hemisphere, I can put it up here or somewhere else and make sure that it's always avoided, right? So in classical physics, you can kind of justify this and you can live with this crutch. But in quantum physics, you can't, right? Why not? Superpositions, path integrals, right? The particle can be in non-accessible regions. And the worst thing that might happen, actually, is your particle explores one path, and it also explores another path, right? And you compare their phases. And if the Dirac string happens to be in between these two paths, what happens? The Aharonov-Bohm effect, right? A charged particle can feel the presence of a magnetic flux, even if it doesn't access the flux itself. But if it circles around it, it can tell. Right. So let's calculate the phase difference for paths like that that are going around the Dirac string one way or another. Right, so the phase difference is going to be the difference in the actions divided by the quantum of action. The action, as you recall, is the integral of the Lagrangian. So it will have other parts, but I'm going to focus on this vector potential part. Right, so it's going to be A dot m dot dt and so I can write it as a dot dm. So if you are evaluating a path difference, a phase difference, right, it's going to be 1 over h bar times a closed loop integral of a dot dm, right, because you have two paths, one going like this, the other like that. If you take the difference of paths 1 and 2, it's the same as taking just a closed loop that combines the two paths in this way, right? So you're taking a closed loop, and so it's going to be the magnetic flux through that loop. So the influence of the string is going to be 1 over h bar times the magnetic flux, which we've just calculated, and it's 4 pi times j, where j is the angular momentum. All right. So even if your spin avoids the tube itself, but it can go on it on the right-hand side and on the left-hand side, the presence of the tube will show up in your quantum mechanics as interference of different paths when you do path integrals. So that's bad, right? Well, not always, right? Not every flux can be felt. If you have a flux that gives a phase difference of 2 pi, It's like there is no flux, same as zero, right? So if this phase difference happens to be 2 pi times an integer, then we're okay. In that case, there'll be no problem. There'll be no interference effect associated with the presence of the direct string. In other words, the direct string will be invisible. So that gives us a condition on the possible values of J, the magnetic, sorry, the mechanical angular momentum. So it's going to be H bar over 2 times an integer. So that's precisely how spins are quantized, right? How angular momentum is quantized. And so this is applicable not just to spins, but also to gyroscopes, right? A gyroscope's angular momentum is also quantized in these units. Cool? Nice. All right. So now we know what the Lagrangian of a ferromagnet is, right? We know what the Lagrangian of a single spin is, and now we can move on to the Lagrangian of a whole ferromagnet. Any questions?
You just forgot about the U because it's not going to contribute at all?
No, it will contribute. But I'm interested in the influence of the string itself.
Right.
If I add the string, do things change? If I move the string around the sphere, do things change? They don't under this condition. Right. So the mechanical part of the action is there. I'm just talking about the geometrical part of the phase. And why am I calling it the geometrical part of the phase? It's because it doesn't depend on how fast the particle is moving, right? So although it's written as A times m dot, it's integrated over time, so it's A dm. Right? This has nothing to do with how fast you're moving. It has to do only with the specific trajectory that the particle is taking. That's why this contribution to the phase of a spin is called geometrical phase or the Berry phase, which is the same thing. So, any other questions? Good. So let's just write down the Lagrangian of a ferromagnet with the magnetization field M of R. Right? So we have a continuous function of spatial coordinate, and this function takes on values on the unit sphere. This is also known as the nonlinear sigma model in particle physics. Okay, so the Lagrangian is going to be the integral of the Lagrangian density, where the Lagrangian density will involve potential energy, which we know, right? So we have already constructed the potential energy. It will be some penalty for having non-uniform spin configurations. Right, so that's that. And now we've figured out the kinetic part. The kinetic part happens to be A of m dot the time derivative of magnetization, and the vector potential has the following, satisfies the following condition, that it gives the field of a monopole, this time J is basically the density of angular momentum, J divided by A to the D, where J is the angular momentum of a single spin, and A to the power D is the volume of a unit cell, density of angular momentum. Great. And so we stipulate that the field also is fixed in length. that's that. Well, we know that it likes uniform configurations. So if it's non-uniform, you have to penalize it somehow. That's a phenomenological constant, right? So as part of your, I think, tutorial, you'll solve a problem where you will start with a microscopic Hamiltonian, right? So the microscopic basis for this, for the potential energy, it'll be something like, maybe I'll just write the Hamiltonian of the Heisenberg model, which would be minus some, we call it K, the exchange constant, times the sum of over the spins Sn dot Sm, and so you're summing over nearest neighbor pairs. Okay, so this is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, actually, the Hamiltonian that Heisenberg wrote in the 30s. So if you think about this term, you can write it, so minus Sm dot Sn, you can write as Sm minus Sn squared divided by 2, and then you have to subtract the lengths of spins, minus Sm squared minus Sn squared. But since the length of the spin is just a number, it's basically the difference of spins squared. And if there's a difference of spins squared, this is like the gradient squared in the continuum formulation. Right? So that's the microscopic basis for having something like that. So in principle, this could be somewhat anisotropic in real space. For instance, if your crystal doesn't have a cubic symmetry, if it has different lattice constants in the x and y and z directions, right? So then you'll have different exchange constants multiplying the x gradient squared, y gradient squared, and z gradient squared. But we'll pretend that we have an isotropic Heisenberg ferromagnet. So it's an idealization, but there are ferromagnets with these properties. So you can actually build something from this. Okay, having written down the Lagrangian, we can now explore the dynamics of the ferromagnet. A tip, if you want a very simple thing, a very simple toy model to understand this Coriolis force and everything related to it, just consider a two-dimensional system in a rotating frame. That will have the Coriolis force. You can write down the Lagrangian from scratch and then see what kind of an addition arises when you put it in a rotating frame. So you'll see very similar terms. All right, so if I want to write down the equations of motion, I can just use the standard Euler-Lagrange prescription. But before I do that, I actually have to take care of the constraint m equal to 1. Right, so rather than work with a system with a constraint, I'm going to switch to spherical coordinates, or spherical angles in this case, and represent the magnetization in terms of two angles, and that takes care of fixing the length. So then the Lagrangian density will look like this. In the gauge that I've chosen, the Berry phase term will look like this. All right, so it's cosine theta minus 1 times phi dot. The sign in the denominator that canceled against the sign when I write the velocity, right? So the velocity along the theta direction is theta dot, but the velocity along the sine direction is sine theta phi dot. Hence the cancellation of the sign. So the potential energy term will look like this. It will be the gradient of theta squared plus sine squared theta times the gradient of phi squared. So now let's write down the Euler-Lagrange equations. For the phi field, I only have it in a couple of places, here phi dot and there grad phi squared. So it'll enter the partial time derivative term, right? So it's here and then minus the gradient of A sine squared theta grad phi equal to 0. This looks like a pretty complicated equation, but I'm not interested in the most general form. I'm going to stick with something simple. I'm going to consider solutions where theta is just a constant. So all spins are tipped away from the vertical axis by the same amount. And so then this is 0, right? And I'm going to consider phi that advances in some direction. So phi is going to be phi of t plus k dot r. So in other words, I'm considering a wave. If you look from the North Pole, the picture will be like this. So your spins would point, right, so there, these are their spheres, right? So they would all point north in the ground state, for instance. But I'm going to tip them a little bit by the same amount in the theta direction, but by varying amounts in the phi direction, right? So they'll be advancing steadily as I go to the right. So k in this case is directed horizontally. Right? So can you imagine this picture? So if I'm moving in this direction, I'm observing that the spins are kind of doing this. So that's a wave. So phi is some time-dependent part plus k dot r. So if phi is linearly proportional to r, it will have a non-zero gradient, and the gradient would be just a constant k. And so this part will vanish as well, since theta is a constant too. Right? So that's 0, and so that equation is satisfied. So the equation for theta can be obtained along similar lines. There's no theta dot term, so there's no time derivative term, but there will be potential terms, right? So you'll have minus j sine theta times phi dot plus a grad squared theta, which vanishes on my assumption, and then minus a sine theta cosine theta times grad phi squared equal to 0. Right, so I can cancel the sign, and my phi dot is going to be minus a divided by j times cosine theta times grad phi squared. And that's k. So it's minus a k divided by j, so k squared actually times cosine theta. So phi is just advancing in time. So you can say phi is omega t plus k dot r, or minus. Right. And so then the frequency just happens to be this. Omega is a cosine theta over spin density j times k squared. And if I have a small deviation from the North Pole, then theta would be nearly zero, so it'll be just approximately a over j k squared. So the dependence of frequency on k is like this. What's the remarkable feature of this dispersion? It's nonlinear, it's quadratic, right? So it's not something that we had yesterday where omega was proportional to k. What else is remarkable? But the fact that it goes to zero, isn't it remarkable too? Right, so omega goes to zero as k goes to zero. Right? So in other words, this is a particle with zero energy in the limit of zero momentum. So it must be a Goldstone mode. Why are there Goldstone modes here? There's a spontaneously broken symmetry. Which one? It's the symmetry of rotating spins, right? Your spins could point this way, that way, anyway, right? So if you start with the North Pole configuration and you rotate all spins globally in the same way, then it costs you nothing. So if you gently twist them, and it's going to cost you very little, and that's basically this fact.
Is Goldstone's theorem if and only if? Like if you have mass excitations, it's always
if? If and only if is a mathematical term.
Well, I mean, sorry, if there are mass excitations, you automatically know there's a broken symmetry?
No. Photons are certainly, at least within the electromagnetism, they're not Goldstone ones, right? It's a different story. No, it doesn't have to be that way, but in this case, there is a reason to be Goldstone modes. Okay. So you can phrase, yeah.
Can you explain again the broken symmetry?
It's a spontaneously broken symmetry of rotation. Right? So when I wrote the Lagrangian, let's pretend this term is not there. If you look at this expression for the potential energy, it's rotationally invariant. If you rotate all spins, then the Lagrangian will not change. There will be a problem over here, but in principle, you can fix it by adding a gauge transformation. Right? And so the problem here will be that the vector potential after a rotation will be different. But it will still correspond to the same magnetic field coming in from all directions. Forget the string for the moment. Right? And so if it describes the same magnetic field, you can fix the vector potential by making a gauge transformation because they're equivalent, right? So this Lagrangian does have this symmetry of global rotation of spins, and that's where the Goldstone mode comes from. Okay, so you can interpret this dispersion relation in terms of particles by saying that there is a particle called a magnon whose energy is h bar omega, which is let's forget the cosine here. It's a over j times h bar k squared, which you can write as h bar k squared divided by 2m. Where the mass can be expressed in terms of h bar a and the spin density. Right. So it's a particle with a non-relativistic dispersion, p squared over 2m. tomorrow or on Thursday in your class discussion, you will, in the tutorial, you'll discuss the properties of these magnons. If you think about the Heisenberg model, the quantum version, essentially a magnon corresponds to the following. You start with all spins pointing up. Every spin has Sz equal to S. And then you reduce one of the spins down to S minus one along the Z direction. So this will be a defect in the structure. And this particle corresponds to a superposition of states of these defects, right? So if you think of a defect, if it's localized, it has a high kinetic energy. If you make a plane wave out of as a superposition of the defect being here at every coordinate with a certain wave function, that would correspond to a magnon, a particle moving with momentum h bar k, something like that. So a plane wave of the particle is precisely this quantized wave. Okay, so that's spin waves. Let's see if magnons actually have any influence. So yesterday, you guys had doubts that phonons can be quantum. Today, I'm going to show you that magnons can be quantum. In fact, the very idea of magnons was conceived in order to explain how the magnetization of a ferromagnet changes with temperature. It was determined experimentally that the magnetization reduces as temperature goes up. So there was an empirical law that the magnetization of a ferromagnet goes down as a power of temperature, T to 3/2. Theta would be some phenomenological constant known experimentally. So let's see how this comes about. So recall that the magnetization and the magnetic moment are connected by a constant. Right, so if you know the angular momentum, the mechanical angular momentum of the system, then its magnetic moment is proportional to it. So a magnon is essentially a reduction of the angular momentum of the ferromagnet by one quantum of angular momentum. So you start with all spins pointing upwards. So each spin has Sz equal to S. And then a magnon corresponds to reducing one of these down by one h bar. So the change in the angular momentum would be equal to the number of magnons times minus h bar. And the corresponding change in the magnetic moment will be that times the gyromagnetic ratio gamma. So we need to figure out how the number of magnons depends on temperature, and then we'll be done. Right. So magnons are particles with a mass, non-relativistic particles with a mass m, which we can determine from various quantities associated with ferromagnet as described over there. And so their energy is it's p squared divided by 2m. Or h bar k squared divided by 2m. The occupation number for a magnon mode with momentum k, or wave number k would be the Bose distribution function. So it's 1 divided by the exponential of beta times the energy minus 1. Right? You guys had statistical mechanics just the previous period, right? So we have that. And so that's the number of magnons with a given wave number at a temperature. So k beta is 1 divided by kBT, Boltzmann constant times temperature. So this is going to be the exponential of beta h bar squared k squared divided by 2m minus 1. So the chemical potential is, you can add the chemical potential by applying a magnetic field. Okay, so here we don't have a magnetic field. Well, they're bosons, right? So that's, it's not the Planck distribution, it's the Bose-Einstein distribution. Yeah, the chemical potential is zero for these particles. Well, the particle number is conserved, but it just happens to be zero if you do the calculation. So it's non-zero if you apply a magnetic field, right? So you can, so imagine what happens if you add, right? So you change the energy from this. It's actually a good question. Yeah, it's something I haven't thought when I was preparing the lecture, but it's a legitimate question, in fact. So let's say we have, we introduce a chemical potential, and so that would be, so E minus mu would be P squared over 2m minus the Bohr magneton times the magnetic field. So that would be the chemical potential. Or magnon. So if you add, actually it'll be plus, yes. So if you add a magnetic field that's opposing the direction of magnetization, so B is negative, this tells you that you have bosons with negative energies, right? So bosons with the lowest momenta E of P with P equal to 0 minus mu would be less than 0. Which means what? There are bosons with negative energies, which means an instability. Right? You can have fermions with negative energies, but you cannot have bosons with negative energies. If you have bosons whose energy hits 0, these magnons will go into a condensate. So, and in fact, there is an instability. Imagine what will happen if you apply a magnetic field this way, but your magnetization points that way. What's going to happen?
Eventually flip.
It's going to flip, right? And this flip will be accompanied by a lot of spins flipping from plus h bar over 2 to minus h bar over 2, right? So there'll be plenty of magnons involved in the process. So that's precisely what will happen. So you have to keep the chemical potential from hitting zero. If you have particles with zero chemical potential and they're bosons, there'll be an infinite number of them formally, right? So here, if we put the chemical potential exactly at zero, only the mode with k equal to zero would have zero energy. And this is the Goldstone mode, right? It's just rotating all spins. A wave with zero wave number is a uniform rotation, right? So it's a global rotation of spins, and that precisely costs zero energy, right? But if you make the chemical potential negative, and the magnetic field positive, then it'll be fine because all bosons will have a positive energy. Okay? So the chemical potential is zero if you don't have a magnetic field applied. Okay, so this is the Bose distribution for magnons. And we can calculate how many magnons there will be at any given temperature now. So we'll have to sum over all wave numbers, n of k. And so the summation over k can be replaced with an integral over the wave numbers divided by 2 pi cubed, multiplied by the volume, right? So then each wave number contains a power of inverse meter. And so you have meters cubed here. So this will be dimensionless. N of k, and so that's the integral of that expression, 1 divided by the exponential of h bar squared k squared divided by 2mt and, well, Boltzmann constant also, right? So kb here, minus 1. It's a complicated integral, but we can make it simple if we replace our integration variable k with the following. So it'll be square root of 2m kbt divided by h bar squared times this variable, let's call this variable x squared. All right, so just the dimensionless version of the wave number squared is x squared.
Aren't they supposed to be massless in that case?
They're massless. They're massless in the sense that they have zero energy in the limit of zero wave number. They have a quadratic dispersion. In that sense, they're not massless. But the technical meaning of a massless here is that the energy vanishes as momentum goes to zero.
So why are we assigning? Is that the logic for assigning it to b squared root to a mass of that
one? No, so the dispersion is what it is, right? So it's not a relativistic field theory. Right? It explicitly breaks relativistic invariance. So you have a particle whose energy is p squared over 2m, so there's no relativistic invariance in this case. But its energy goes to zero as momentum goes to zero, and that's what a Goldstone mode has.
Because of this integral, since you're integrating over all momenta, is this really counting the number of magnons? Because it's only true for small momenta that you would properly be called a magnon, right?
A very good question. In principle, we have to do this on a lattice. Right, and on a lattice, this would be not over the infinite range, but it would be for kx going between minus pi over a and pi over a. And for ky, they're doing the same thing, and for kz, right? So it's just integrating over the first Brillouin zone.
But even at the upper cutoff, the dispersion relation would be nonlinear, right?
So the dispersion relation will not be this, I agree. But in fact, at low temperatures, this is not important because at low temperatures, if the energy of the magnon is much greater than thermal energy, then you can just neglect the quantity of, right? So it just goes to zero. So the contribution of magnons with high momenta is going to vanish very quickly. So at low temperatures, you can neglect the fact that you have these restrictions because those magnons contribute very little.
Okay. But just properly speaking, there's no such thing as a magnon with high momenta.
There is. In fact, in the tutorial, you'll work with magnons in the entire Brillouin zone, not only with small wave numbers, but also with wave numbers going all the way toward pi over a.
Mm-hmm. Even though the dispersion relations, it's not Goldstone mode anymore.
The dispersion relation on the lattice will be, well, I can't do it for you.
Well, this will be the tutorial problem.
So wait until Thursday. Thursday will it be?
Yeah.
So on Thursday you'll just do that, and you'll see that it'll be quadratic at the bottom, just like we described here. But then at the top it'll curve away from the parabola. It's still a magnon. There's no reason not to call it a magnon. It's a lattice magnon. Okay. So in the lattice problem, the dispersion would be slightly different from parabolic. But it'll agree with the continuum theory in the long wavelength limit. No, a magnon is just the quantum of a spin wave. Right. So that's the meaning in which I use it.
Like here, we so far derive everything using quantum mechanics and haven't actually done the quantization process.
We haven't done the quantization, that's right. In fact, let me finish this and I'll show you how the quantization can be inferred, if not done. Okay. So it's a scalar field theory again. Just a complex field, as you'll see shortly. But let me finish this calculation and we'll just come to that. In fact, this is something I should have done right between the spin waves and the magnons, but I got carried away. Okay. So anyway, so what you'll have here is, as you convert this k to x times whatever you have, important thing is that you have t to the power 1/2 there, right? So this would be something like d3x times temperature to the power 3/2, right? So for each power of k, you add a power 1/2 of temperature and the rest of the constants, which don't particularly concern me. So you'll have v t3/2 and a dimensionless integral. You can just leave the integral as is, or you can evaluate that if you want. But the important point is you've got the reduction in the number of magnons scale as t to 3/2. And that's precisely how the magnetization of the ferromagnet, a uniform and isotropic ferromagnet, goes down with temperature. So it deviates from the zero temperature limit by a constant times t to 3/2. More questions?
In the classical spin lattice, can you draw what a localized magnon looks like?
Yeah, so if we do spins 1/2, okay? So this would be our ground state, and it's an exact ground state of the Heisenberg model. It's an eigenstate, and you can show that. Right? And then, so I'll do it for a chain. And then you can construct an excitation where a single spin goes from s equal to s to s equal to s minus 1. In this case, it's minus 1/2. So this is a particle localized at a given point in the lattice. Okay, so I can call this state, if I number these spins, I will call this state 4. Which is a coordinate eigenstate. It does, so you can rotate all spins continuously. Right? So it's a spin 1/2 Heisenberg model. This is an eigenstate of the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. You can check that. This is not, because you have broken translational symmetry. Right? You have something that's different at point 4 than anywhere else. When you act on this state, or generically on state with the particle localized somewhere, what you will find, so this will be the Heisenberg Hamiltonian acting on the state with the flipped spin at site n. What you'll find is that this will be some number e times the same state, and then minus j times n minus 1, or k in this case, right? So we called it k, minus k times n plus 1. So it's not an eigenstate of energy, because the action of the Hamiltonian doesn't preserve the state. and it connects it to the state in which the spin is back in order, but neighboring spins are flipped. Okay? So the Heisenberg-Hamiltonian propagates the spin, the flipped spin, the defect around the lattice. And if instead of working with eigenstates of position, which these are, you work with a momentum eigenstate or a plane wave, right? So what you'll do is you'll switch to states with a well-defined momentum. Right? So you go from position eigenstates to momentum eigenstates. In the basis of momentum eigenstates, the energy will be something. And you can calculate what it is. And that state is the state of a magnet with momentum h bar k and a well-defined energy.
If you had taken the ground state and rotated, say, the spin 4 by some infinitesimal angle theta, would that still be, would you still call that a magnon?
Okay. So here's one interesting thing, right? You can take k equal to 0. Let's take the limit of k going to 0. If I set k equal to 0, then there will be a uniform superposition of all spins up and one spin down. Right? So it'll be just a wave with 0 wave number. And actually, it's still a state with total angular momentum fixed, but tilted. If you think about, right, so if you start with the ground state, right, so this ground state has total angular momentum equal to what? Let's say we have total n spins. So this state has total angular momentum equal to n times 1/2, right? And it has projection as z equal to n over 2 also, right? The same as the total s. You can think about spins, states with the rotated angular momentum, right? Which still has s equal to n over 2 and as z equal to, let's say, n over 2 minus 1. What will this state look like? Will be a superposition of it'll be precisely that superposition, right? No, that's a quantum model, right? So if you have n spins 1/2, what does the state with the total maximal spin in the projection reduced by 1 look like? That's what it looks like. Because it has to have a total as z equal to n over 2 minus 1, which all of those states do have. And it'll be a uniform superposition of them. So it turns out that the magnon with 0 wave number is just a global rotation, roughly speaking. And it costs no energy. And so the magnon with 0 momentum is supposed to have 0 energy. Because it's a Goldstone mode. It's just another way of saying that. Am I making sense? Well, what I like about today's class is that you guys are asking physics questions, not mathematics questions. No, this is really important. Okay, it means that there is an impedance mismatch and we're trying to speak the same language. We're making an attempt to do that. It's not the mathematics that throws you off. It's the physics that's not something you've seen before. Good. I like that. This takes some getting used to.
How can a flip of a spin cause zero energy?
Well, if you flip the spin, that by itself does not cause zero energy, right? So that state is not an eigenstate of energy. But if you take a superposition of states where all spins are up and one spin has a reduced projection, that turns out to be a state with the total spin still of the same length, but with the projection reduced. And so that is the same energy state.
Is that untrue, though, when you have a very large number of spins?
No, you can do this in a finite system, it will still work. You don't have to take the thermodynamic limit. In fact, take two spins and work it out. Right? What does the state like this look like? It's one spin up, the other down, plus vice versa, right? So that's a total spin one state for two spins one half. So it works even for such a small system. It works even for one spin, in which case it's trivial. This state and that state, they have the same total spin.
When you say it doesn't cost energy, what exactly do you mean? The mode is...
Well, so imagine the Heisenberg model for two spins, right? The energy is lowest when the two spins are parallel. That is when they have a total spin one, right? So one such obvious state is two spins pointing up. The next state will be up, down, plus down, up. That's still a state with a total spin one. It has the same energy. Well, it's the ground state of the Heisenberg model, right? Because we remember the trick when we wrote the energy. Right, so I could write minus S1 dot S2 as minus, or sorry, S1 plus S2 squared. Well, let me do it this way. Right, so it's minus that plus S1 squared plus S2 squared. So the energy is minimized. Well, these are constants. So I just have to pay attention to the total spin squared, right? So the energy is minimized when the total spin is maximal. And for spins one half, it means spin one. Right, so the ground states would be up, 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 down, plus down, up, divided by root two, and then down, down. These are the three ground states of two spins in the Heisenberg model. Right, so that's the polarized ground state we considered, and this is the state with a single magnon. This is the magnon, right? So here it's on the second side, here it's on the first side.
In this example, we have only one excited state.
Yeah.
The singlet state.
Yeah. Well, you can say this is the second excited state where all spins have flipped.
Yeah, but you could start with this one.
Or you can start with this one, right? Now you can move on and you can do it with three spins. Your ground state will look like this. Another ground state, again, will look like up, 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 down, plus up, down, up, plus down, up, up, divided by root 3. That's still a ground state because it has the same total spin. OK? And if you want an excitation, which costs a non-zero energy, you have to add some phases here, a state that would be orthogonal to this one. And so that would correspond to this magnon, this flipped spin, traveling through the lattice with a non-zero momentum. That's what a magnon is in this picture, OK? But a much nicer picture is just consider a spin wave where the spins precess like that. The quantum of that is a magnon. This is how I picture it. But it's useful to picture it in both ways, in fact. So you'll do that in the tutorial. So we didn't have time to actually quantize it. And we should break up before Dr. Daladovich starts throwing chairs at me. But if you want, you can stay and I will tell you how the quantization proceeds. It'll be just a few minutes. But so at this point, we're done.